And good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and I would like to thank you for joining the Public Health Data Systems Task Force. We do have a few guest presenters with us today, and I would like to thank them for participating. All task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is always welcomed, either in the Zoom chat or during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 11:50 Eastern time this morning. I'm going to begin roll call of our task force members, so when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. Jillian Haney.
Here, good morning.
Arianne Malik.
Good morning.
Rochelle Bolton.
Good morning.
Hans Bootendijk. Heather Cook Sinclair. Aaron Holt Coyne.
She'll be a few minutes late.
Thank you. Charles Cross. Steve Eichner. Joe Gibson. Raj Gabarty, Tim Jurgis, John Kansky.
Good morning.
Brian Thomas-Karras.
Present.
Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Jennifer Layden.
Good morning.
Leslie Leonard. Hung Lu.
Good morning.
Mark Marostica.
Good morning.
Aaron Meary.
Good morning.
Alexandra Muggy.
Good morning.
Stephen Murphy. Elio Oliveira.
Good morning.
Amy Pina.
Present. Good morning.
Abby Sears. Vivian Singletary.
Good morning.
And Phil Sutherland. And Cheryl Turney, I believe, is not going to be able to join us today. So thank you, everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Arianne and Jillian for their opening remarks.
Good morning. I think some of you saw yesterday that one of our, minor little known papers, the New York Times, did a I think it was above the fold front page. Hard to tell because I work off the digital edition. Report on public health data systems and some of the failures thereof in both COVID and monkeypox. We were having a brief chat prior to this meeting opening, and you know, when you look at the root causes of the issues in that story, there is both the chronic underfunding of public health infrastructure. And then issues related to lack of digitization or incomplete digitization. And as much as we'd want to in this task force, we're unlikely to address chronic underfunding and lack of state funding for public health digital infrastructure, but we can do something about the lack of digitization. And in particular, I think we can do stuff. We can do something around the two most prominently noted issues in that report. Number one, the lack of real-time, easily available demographic information sufficient to localize and assess burden of disease on particular communities. And number two is the great difficulty in getting appropriate information for case investigation that helps characterize disease burden, disease outbreaks, and conduct appropriate epidemiology. And I think the good news is we've already done much of the legwork in terms of what the next appropriate lift is, but it might be a useful test case for us to look at our recommendations and ask ourselves if universally applied, if applied through ONC in partnership with CDC, and assuming appropriate funding for stilts nationwide, would we address the root causes that that led to the outcomes in that report? That might be a useful test for us. We are here to talk about an area that performed reasonably well in COVID times. You know, I remember early on in the COVID pandemic, noting Farzad Mastashari's thread looking at the New York publicly available dashboards on flu-like illness, and being able to see really in real time or very close to real time the epidemic spreading through New York. The benefits that we've had for particularly ADT, ED data flowing into public health systems does not mean that there isn't much more that we can do. In particular, getting more information from more settings of care, making sure that information is more universally available. And then it has been a perennial issue, making sure that we've got the right balance for privacy and security for universal access for this data. So we've got a good panel, Jillian will lead us through the panel discussion. Jillian, anything more you want to do in terms of opening for this meeting?
Yeah, I just want to briefly say that, you know, syndromic surveillance has been in place for quite a few years, and it's a much simpler feed than electronic case reporting. There is also an established HL standard, which I believe is in widespread adoption and adherence to. You know, syndromic surveillance has proved to be extremely useful during the pandemic for situational awareness. And often, like the curve, we don't often see it like an increase in the curves, and then the case counts and hospitalizations would follow. So, you know, it was extremely effective. It is a partially de-identified data set, though. So, you know, names and full addresses are not included in the data set that gets sent up to CDC's BioSense platform for use. And so this data set does actually not link directly with case-based use, with states' case-based surveillance systems. And I think that that needs to be noted. And there is, again, there's very widespread adoption in the United States with a couple of notable exceptions. I think the other thing is that for syndromic surveillance is that it really does have broader application in public health beyond infectious diseases. And I'm going to be really interested to hear from our panelists in terms of their experience, in terms of data completeness and utility and any pain points that they might have experienced. So I'll pause there and introduce our first panelist, Rosa Urgas with Massachusetts Department of Public Health, who I know extremely well and have worked with for many, many years. I'm delighted to have her here, and she really is an expert in her field. And then Carl Sabatier from CDC, who is a lead in the community of practice for syndromic surveillance. And lastly, Aaron Murray from Baptist Health, so, and representing the provider community. So welcome to the three of you. And Rosa, go ahead and kick things off, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Jillian. Thanks for having me on this to discuss this important topic. So I'm just going to dive right in with some bullet points, kind of trying to address some of the items that were requested from the task force. So starting, I've been working in syndromic surveillance in Massachusetts for quite some time in my current role for something like 8 years, kind of working to ingest the data, but also really to figure out the best ways to make the data useful for public health surveillance and eventually action and hopefully improving the health of our citizens. In Massachusetts, what I would report out is that we have a really good, robust network of emergency department syndromic surveillance providers. We have been really blessed in Massachusetts to have great relationships with our local partners. They're always really eager to participate and help us to do the work of public health surveillance. We have great relationships with the people on the ground, the local folks at the emergency departments, and they and their partners at the various vendors that represent them have done a really nice job with all of the quality assurance and completeness that we have asked with respect to the current standards. Where we sometimes fall apart is where the vendors are sort of looking at the standards, and the standards sometimes don't directly connect the data element, sort of the technical specification of the data element, with what the public health department truly means in terms of meaningful data for public health action. The other challenge that we have has been onboarding urgent care locations. We think that those data are really useful for emergent trends and sort of different kinds of surveillance. And we have had some challenges with the urgent care locations. I think it's largely because there isn't an overarching, at least as I understand it, there's not an overarching agency that's in charge of regulating all of the urgent care data in the same way that emergency departments are managed. So with emergency department data, we were easily able to sort of tap into many different sources of information to understand the landscape of emergency department, not only the facilities, but the visits that happen there and who the populations are, who they serve. But with the urgent care data locations, it's been a little harder to get that landscape and understanding of the big picture. So I think one of the things that we could really use to improve the overarching utility of these data is to go beyond getting the specific data elements to the specific local jurisdiction, but rather to do more to have a common understanding of the public health utility of those data, not only for the jurisdiction who receives the data, but also for a shared utility of the data. So we're certainly able to use the data for many public health surveillance purposes, but we would be better able to use those data if we had a clearer understanding not only within our state and our providing facilities, but also across states, not only in terms of the collection of the data, but the opportunities for sharing data with other local health partners and potentially there's a need for some clarification of which data are the most useful to public health, and potentially some evolution of the way that the data are ingested and processed within the NSSP ecosystem once they are received by public health. And we really are in need of a larger conversation about data sharing and communication within local jurisdictions and public health partners.
Thank you, Rosa. I'm sure people will have questions following the panel presentation. So, Carl?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity. Background on myself, I'm presently the acting program lead for the National Syndromic Surveillance Program, but have sort of a long history both in the state of Georgia and now a little bit here at CC in working with syndromic surveillance. And I guess there were a few questions that I was asked to consider in presenting this panel, and sort of to reinforce some of the things that Rosa brought up. I would agree. I think we have a fairly mature messaging guide in terms of the basic data that are a part of our feed. We have an incremental revision that's in process, and we're trying to get past COVID far enough to get that through the SVAT process and part of what can be used as a standard for the vendors to develop against. And hopefully that will unfold over the next 6 to 8 months. you know, I think that in terms of gaps, you know, we've observed that while, you know, parts of the data flow are certified, it's not always as close to the source as it could be. You know, and when this occurs, sometimes we have a challenge because upstream data systems fail to provide something that's sort of key, and the certification that's drive might be at an HIE level or another place that doesn't necessarily drive compliance all the way back to where the data are collected. And so that's, you know, in terms of thinking about gaps related specifically to the F2 criteria, I think that's one place that we might be able to think about. You know, I think to think about some of the things that Rosa brought up in terms of, you know, data sources, it's, you know, we talked about resources early on and, you know, the reality is this work of syndromic surveillance, you know, depending on the use cases that we want it to support. And I say we generally, because it's a highly distributed activity around the country. You know, we, while there is a national system, you know, it's very much a collaboration of our state and local partners across the country to provide these data and generally have, you know, somewhat specific perspectives on the work. And that ranges from, you know, wanting syndromic to have a really broad focus where, you know, it's capturing ED visits, it's capturing urgent cares, it's capturing inpatient visits. In some jurisdictions, they want identified data in their local system to be able to connect that back to their cases. And that happens in some places. Many other jurisdictions take a much more limited view. You know, they're like, don't want to carry the responsibility of onboarding urgent cares in their jurisdiction because they feel like the emergency department captures the portion of the data that they're most interested in terms of the surveillance activities that they do. And so it's a broad range of perspectives on the activity. I mean, I think it is generally shared that it's something that, you know, by being routine, by being timely, by being automated and casting a broad net in terms of the conditions that it can be applied to, it fills a niche that is different from a lot of the other surveillance activities that we have. You know, in that and you know, to the degree that we can, you know, address, you know, some of the completeness of the basic pieces, I think that's you know, something that all would agree are worthy activities. And, you know, although we have, I mean, in looking at just take race and ethnicity as an example, in the context of COVID, you know, we have almost 92% completeness of race data in the emergency department data now. The underlying quality of that and some of the challenges and how it's collected, there's a whole other range and discussion that can occur with that. But just on the base level of what's provided in the data. And so I think, you know, all of that is challenging to have certification drive. In other words, I mean, so much of this is based on the work of our partners having good relationships with their healthcare facilities and encouraging them to take a look at what they're providing and to improve it. I'm not sure how much more can be done from a regulation perspective in terms of the guide and what ONC can bring to the equation in terms of certification, but I'm certainly open to hear others' thoughts on that as well.
Thank you, Carl. Aaron.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me this morning. So first, I want to take us back to something you mentioned earlier, Jillian, and my colleagues here have also mentioned, which is that we've had syndromic surveillance for a while, right? Even for the public health fans here that can recall the mid-1800s with Jon Snow in London, right? Running the water pump and the outbreak of cholera, right? I mean, observatory and observation and making sure that sort of tactile evidence is gathered and shared and disseminated to get to a correlation has always been there and is part of the human psyche. I think what's happened here though from the provider side is obviously we've gone down the digitization of records, and I've had now the pleasure or pain of dealing with COVID-19 in two different markets, both in Austin, Texas, and here in Jacksonville, Florida, Northern Florida market. So seeing two very different states and how they handle it, but yet the similarities from a provider side of the challenges. So let's talk about benefits first. Positive guy, I want to start with some benefits. Number one, we mentioned a little earlier, it was said HL standard is there, right? It works well, leverages Loink. It actually does a decent job. Is it perfect? No, but it does a decent job. And we were able to correlate and cascade events. Arian, you'll probably remember this in our policy committee days. I remember very clearly Zika outbreak, and we weren't tracking pregnancy as a status, a mandatory field. And that caused a little bit of a kerfuffle, and we were able to get in front of that. So we're constantly learning and updating those standards and making data fields mandatory and having to track that down. Second thing, the broad data that we are gathering has a potential to identify emerging diseases quickly and potential large outbreaks. At UT, in my prior life, we were doing this exactly to figure out the hotspots, specifically with the students and the dormitories they were living in and the apartments they were living in, to figure out who to isolate. This is before the vaccines were available, who to isolate, how to make sure you break the cycle, a chain of transmission. And then, of course, you know, the other benefit here with the large data sets that are coming out, particularly are focused on the emergency departments, which is interesting, right? You think about how many people show up to a, you know, either rural medicine clinic or ambulatory setting, long-term care, and others that could have disease elements, and that data is not shared. But right now, we do have large data sets available to us, again, focused primarily on those emergency departments, freestanding EDs and so forth, and going through there. So that has a ton of upside in being able to track and trace out what's going on. Let's talk about gaps. I think that's part of the challenge here with syndromic surveillance. So number one, for emerging illnesses, we're often dependent on the addition of new data elements and updates, right? I recall even in early days of COVID-19 outbreak, the CDC was changing the requirement of data needed to be sent in and gathered. And this was different also than what Austin Public Health was asking us, and here in Florida were asking us, as we learn more about the disease, that information was, okay, we need to update this case form needs to be changed, these data types need to be added, et cetera, et cetera. We were very dependent on the vendors, the electronic health record community, to help jump in and create those new fields or whatever needed to happen there. So it was really a long, drawn out, laborious effort. But we got there through blood, sweat, and tears. But that's something that absolutely could be accelerated, is how do we get those new data elements propagated and disseminated immediately? Even with some of the updates we've done with USCDI and some of that task force work, again, that Arian and Dr. Lane and others have led, which is sort of that fast path past track, right? How do we get those data elements accelerated in case of an emergency like this? Second thing, internal hospitals, the provider side, we don't have the resources to be able to build new labs out or emerging labs to enable monitoring, which is really dependent on availability of resources. When you're fighting COVID-19, case in point, even just a few months ago, as we had the latest wave go through Florida, half of my IT department was out at some point or time, give or take, at the same time with COVID. So your resources are limited. So are there availability of resources from the CDC or other funding sources to drop in to major tertiary care centers and academic medical centers and others, which are taking part in helping a large population of people, right? That's a possibility there. Another item there. We have a much less common, highly specialized testing process, which is still on paper and fax to central laboratories, and does have delayed notification manual processes. Again, I forget who's from Austin, Texas, but though maybe remember this, it was around May or June of 2020. There was a very public thing on the news about the fact that fax machines were causing a bottleneck of COVID-19 testing and resulting, right, which hampered syndromic surveillance efforts because it's all paper-based. It's not discrete data. We've got to enable those data elements to be enabled. And that's not the fault of public health. They just don't have funding. Third, lack of feedback on community or healthcare provider data that could help inform clinical operations. Oftentimes, the hospitals were trying to share information with each other, going, what's your census? What's your bed count? What are people presenting in your EDs? Particularly in the early days, we were looking at things like high blood pressure, temperature, and others as those leading indicators. And it was very difficult to get that data. The hope is information blocking or information sharing, as we lovingly call it now, will allow for that to be easier in the future. Not so. I'll tell you, there's hospitals that I'm still continuing to talk to saying, we got to share data easily, guys. This can't be this difficult. Fourth, lack of bi-directional information on community surveillance measures, right? Local internet searches on symptoms, wastewater surveillance, all those components could aid in the richness of data collection and drive insight, right? Those are not routinely built into EHRs and or routinely sent out as items to track. If you're lucky enough to live in a locale, I believe Massachusetts, New York, California, these very robust states that have a good infrastructure for that, you may have access to that data via local HIE, but generally speaking, that's not available to folks. Next, We would really like to help incorporate standards for reporting for home surveillance testing to add to the richness of surveillance data sets. You know, we need to create those standards for self-testing and self-reported testing. Today, that's a big gap. We rely on that. I think there are some personal health records out there that claim to be able to store your data, but does that have the veracity necessary for a clinical decision? Probably not, because it's not an official data element. And then, of course, quality and surveillance monitoring programs are highly dependent on this little thing called HIPAA, right? And we got to make sure that, you know, we should look at, maybe this is a congressional action here to solidify in statute that covered entities would not be liable for HIPAA penalties for sharing patient information pursuant to patient requests to share the information, and making sure for syndromic surveillance purposes, that's permissible. There's been tremendous amount of confusion saying how much data can we share legally and without, you know, without having, you know, breaching HIPAA and the tenets around that, that needs to be codified into law. Next, you know, really developing that streamlined, simple authorization for patients to share their information and researchers at their discretion, you know, connecting the EHRs to research tools to allow for clinical trials and so forth and so on, all around patient privacy and all about making sure that that HIPAA is modernized to that. I also want to thank the Health Innovation Alliance for some of those bullets, because I found them to be very insightful and spot on. And I support that from a provider perspective. But net, there's a lot of upside here for syndromic surveillance. We need to get in front of the ball quickly, and we need to be able to turn this around. Otherwise, the next COVID outbreak and novel outbreak is just around the corner. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to all of our panelists. I just want to clarify, I'm like reading the chats, and I just want to clarify one thing about syndromic surveillance data is that the data are query-based in the sense that there's no need to develop syndromes from which to trigger the data to be sent to the BioSense platform. The feed actually contains all the ICD and chief complaint data that are necessary for public health to actually write those queries to be able to determine like data trends in that way. And the community of practice is extremely robust in terms of sharing those queries that states and locals are running and making those data available at the local level to very in a very granular way. So I just want to really clarify that, whereas electronic case reporting or electronic laboratory reporting are very much based on Loink and SNOMED and or in concert with ICD-10 codes. So it's really a different set of information that is being sent and the way that the data are actually accessed for public health use with syndromic surveillance. So in terms of lining up our first questions here, I do want to get back. I just want to make sure that people note that Steve Lane's comment in the chat about potentially using CMS to propose some recommendations for certification on. I think that's a really important point. So Arian, I see you have your hand up first, please.
Yeah, so I was going to go in the same direction. Just to clarify, so I'm going to sort of summarize and repeat back what I heard in the panel session. Number one, the existing implementation guide is good. We haven't heard significant issues with the implementation guide itself. Number two, what data we put into the implementation guide, in particular, the conversation we've had around better granularity of demographic data, better ability to subsegment race and ethnicity beyond the five OMB codes, et cetera, would be useful. In some cases, we're getting the ADT feed that feeds syndromic surveillance downstream from the actual originating system. And it would be useful to make sure that we've got the incentive system, certification system, policy system that ensures that regardless of who the intermediary is or the actor is that's involved in the chain of transmission, that we're able to capture the information as it originates at source, rather than taking, you know, secondary downstream systems, for example, off of an HIE that may not be the actual admit information that came into the ED. I believe, and I'm wonder whether our CMS counterparts on the panel can clarify, but I believe that the way our so we have certification criteria that are broad. I believe we plug those certifications, that certification program into a promoting interoperability program that is associated with acute care. And so one of the reasons that we're not getting urgent care or ambulatory care data is because we don't actually have a certification. Sorry, we don't actually have CMS programmatics that hook into ambulatory or urgent care in the way that we have CMS programmatics that hook into acute care. So would request clarification either from ONC or CMS or anybody else on that topic. But I believe that we've got an opportunity to make recommendations for broader use of the syndromic surveillance implementation guide and certification criteria in ways that would assist our ability to get emergent information from urgent care or from primary care, where that's the primary location where patients are being treated. So that was more of a reflection and thoughts and some questions either to ONC staff or to CMS just to help us clarify. But that's kind of what's coming to me as the conclusions out of this panel.
Thanks, Arian. Is there anyone from ONC or CMS that could clarify or respond to the Arian's question?
Jillian, this is Rachel. I'm going to actually punt it to Steve Eichner because I think he
made it. Okay, great. All right. Great. Good morning, Ike. Go ahead. You're on mute, or we can't hear you yet.
That better?
Yes. Hi.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Double muted myself. The implementation guide actually does support reporting from urgent care, and specifically it's called calls that out in the implementation guide. However, current federal regulations for promoting interoperability does not provide financial incentive for non-hospital providers to participate in syndromic surveillance reporting.
That's very clear. So thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Did you have another comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, I did. Just a couple points real clear. Just to clarify, the querying of syndromic surveillance data does not happen with public health querying information systems hosted by the provider. Instead, the ADT messages are forwarded to public health and the complete database is queried by public health that consolidates data from multiple providers. So it's not querying for an individual record coming directly out of a provider's system. I think we also need to be cognizant if we're looking at changing how we're using syndromic surveillance data, which generally has been used at the population level, that was kind of some of its origin level, looking at data in aggregate coming out of Department of Defense or health risks in that space. If we're looking at changing usage, we're recommending things like clinical trials and like, then we also need to probably look at addressing provenance issues as well, because I'm a patient, I've got a rare disease. If someone's asking me about my rare disease, I want to know where they got my name and why exactly they're asking me about it. And if that data is being harvested off the syndromic surveillance report, I'd like to know that at the end of the day.
I think that's an important point to note. Thank you, Steve. Mark.
Yeah, you know, with an understanding that in syndromic surveillance, the receipt and ingestion of data by public health is of the utmost importance and is the main concern, I wanted to introduce a possible other element that we may want to consider. And I think Arian kind of alluded to it in bidirectional, because in talking with our public health clients, when they receive syndromic data, they're also interested in converting that data into actionable information in communicating what they've seen to the reporting hospitals. If they see a potential outbreak in the community, they would like to communicate that to all the hospitals who may not see it as a community, looking at just their hospital-based data. Wanted to ask the panelists and the panel, is that something that is a valid concern, that the bidirectional communication from public health to the reporting agencies is something that we should consider in this scope, or is outside of the scope in this consideration?
So I'm going to turn it to Rosa in a second, but I believe that the, one of the beauties of the National Syndromic Surveillance Program is that all of the data are hosted with by CDC in the aggregate in what are called lockers. And these lockers can be divided up into with various filters on it to determine access. So the state, you know, would have the broadest access to all of the information contained therein. But hospitals and providers can query their own data so that they will have that, you know, have access to the data that they're reporting up. Rosa, do you want to address that more?
I'd like to elaborate on that because Texas most certainly for all hospital providers that are participating in our syndromic surveillance program have direct access, not just to unified data, but to our entire, to all of their data that they've contributed to the system, along with all the analytical tools that public health has developed. We are very careful about limiting access to hospital data to only the contributing hospital so that other hospitals cannot see data from other hospitals within their marketplace. We do publish statewide data, and local health departments can see data from entities within their jurisdiction. But that's one of the potential balance points, is that there's a lot of very valuable data that would let people understand what a hospital may be focused on. And that's a consideration in looking at the release of data and how do we balance that from a system perspective.
So Ike, that's interesting. With an understanding that hospitals can access the data if they want to, do you see value in allowing public health the ability to proactively alert hospitals that there might be a outbreak in their community and to access that data rather than do it passively?
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of why the system exists in the first place. Going back to the original concept of syndromic surveillance was to look at an early warning detection system where you might not be aware that it was a particular disease or a particular risk, but that, hey, we were seeing an abnormal number of gastrointestinal concerns in a particular hospital, being able to reflect that not only back to the originating hospital, but other hospitals and other entities in the area. And it's really a matter of how much information one pushes out, at what level, with what identifying information associated with it is kind of a question that's on the table, or that can be revisited and updated. There's not, from a technical perspective, it's easy to open the data to additional users. And
yeah, that capability exists.
Yeah. It's a matter of what's proper, what's legal, what's, you know, in the rest of that context.
And I think it's important in that to not remove the human dimension. The syndromic surveillance as a practice is highly automated in that the data flow happens from the point of generation in EHR all the way through to the analysis. And a part of that is alerting algorithms and all of the like, but it still needs to be interpreted. And, you know, when you think about case data and the investigative process that goes to build up a case report, unless you have some similar process in your syndromic data flow, or you manage the information management stream of syndromic practice, you won't be able to have consistently interpretable information. And so while the system can alert, you know, most of our focus in terms of the system is focused on how do we get the analysts, the public health analysts who are trained and understand the practice, to focus on the most important things so that they can then turn that into actionable information. I think that's probably the way to think about this. We technically possibly absolutely could send unfiltered alerts to healthcare providers, but it's the potential for alerts to go that aren't really of value or use to the particular provider. I mean, there's a lot of risk there. And, you know, I don't know how actionable that actionable that will be. You know,
I think, Carl, you're making a really, really important point. There is an art to the science of interpreting social, you know, syndromic surveillance data. I remember my days investigating what I thought were 5 botulism alerts, and it turned out that it was a family of 5 that had actually gone to a care center to have their eyes checked, and blurry vision was coming through on the alert. So there's definitely, you know, there's definitely a need to have the experts really look at those data and review. Bryant, I think you had your hand up next.
Yeah, thank you. It got inadvertently lowered. I wanted to, I really like the suggestion of expanding beyond emergency departments, and wanted to share our experience in Washington State, who is, as many of you know, tends to pioneer some of these concepts. We've been collecting ambulatory care, primary care, urgent care, and even some select specialty care settings data for years now. And it's very, very useful and insightful. And I think was used heavily during, as you know, COVID hit first here. Our epidemiologists created a specialized query for not flu-like illness, but COVID-like illness. I think we called it SARS-like illness in the early days before COVID became the name, and then shared that query out with our partner states so that they can monitor their data feeds. But just to give you some idea of the power of it, making that expansion, and I would love for our task force to make that expansion becomes a nationwide practice. We received from emergency departments over the past 3 months, you know, 730,000 visits, which sounds like a lot until you compare it with the ambulatory clinic and urgent care visit numbers, which in that same period of time numbered 3.3 million records. So it gives you a much broader view of what's going on in the community. But we've also gone beyond that. We've actually, and this speaks to that HIPAA cover, we've put into rule actual guidance for those hospitals and ambulatory care, giving them permission to participate in, you know, what the feds call a voluntary effort, not required. And that the participation, that the partnership with our clinical providers to do the right thing and to participate has been phenomenal. And the other one that I want to mention that is really useful in these recent months to differentiate between severe COVID versus COVID requiring hospitalization is the ability for us to have inpatient records incorporated into our syndromic surveillance feed. So it's not just the emergency department visit, but being able to track that person actually being admitted to either intensive care or the regular wards. And the numbers are much smaller, of course, 157,000 records in that same 3-month period. That we're able to track and see what's happening with those cases. So incredibly valuable. And I think more states should take advantage of the science.
Thanks, Bryant. Very much agree. Marian?
Yeah, so thank you for that. So maybe a clarification on that particular point, which is, does the implementation guide currently support inpatient data collection? Is this again an issue of yes. the hooks, the policy hooks that are attached to syndromic surveillance, where the implementation guide supports broader use, but but it's only used in practice in EDs because of how we define our incentive program? Do you happen to know the answer to the question?
Inpatient and ambulatory are both covered in the implementation guide.
Yeah, perfect. So, you know, I think again, it's the case here is that we've got we have a certification program and implementation guidance that are appropriate, but we hook that certification program into programmatics that expose it only in a limited use. And it would be important to get both inpatient data and ambulatory and urgent care data. On this subject of alerting back, what occurs to me, again, just thinking about our charge and charter, is that we don't have an implementation guide. One could imagine, for example, decision support hooks being used as an implementation guide inside EHRs to be able to expose public health alerts. One could imagine other technical means to expose public health alerts into EHR systems. We don't yet have an implementation guide, and so it might be appropriate to draft recommendations that ONC work with the community to create and test such a guide to enable public health alerts. And then, you know, to the previous points, one would imagine that those public health alerts would be used by public health for validated alerts, not be used blindly to send unfiltered alerts back into settings of care. But to the extent that we can translate this discussion into recommendations, that's the thought that I have for how we might do this, is to note that there's a need for bidirectional communication, note that there's a lack of an implementation guide, and then make a recommendation to ONC to facilitate development and testing of such a guide.
Carl?
No, thanks. I just wanted to weigh in on the urgent care discussion, and not to be an anchor on progress, but I think something really important to keep in mind, and I think one of the reasons why urgent care hasn't become a required reporting measure, is that it can be resource intensive. You know, in order to establish the connections needed from a technical perspective to move the data, to have the dedicated personnel to review and ensure that the quality of the information coming in, and then ultimately to have the analysts available to review and act on it from a surveillance perspective. And I think different jurisdictions around the country are in different places with respect to their ability to put resources towards this activity. And so anything that we would do there needs to be sensitive to that reality, in that, you know, it may not be tenable for a given jurisdiction to receive data from urgent cares and onboard them, given their the way that they're funded and the priority that this particular activity is given from a public health perspective within their health department. So just a note of caution on that. But
Rosa, I'm going to let you have the last word before we turn it over to Arian to look at our task worksheet. So, Rosa?
Thanks, Jillian. There have been a few threads that I've sort of wanted to respond to, so I'm going to try to catch them all. The first, I guess, I'll talk about is this idea that we've discussed and I think is really clear, that the implementation guides do, in fact, allow for urgent care, ambulatory and inpatient. But as I was starting to describe at the beginning, it seems like even though those implementation guides do allow for those the transmission of those data, there's not a lot of really clear, common, shared understanding of exactly which data elements are necessary in order to identify those visits and importantly to appropriately aggregate those visits across the patient care experience. So one of the challenges that we've had, and this is where I'm thinking about really clarifying, not necessarily the letter of the law, but sort of the common understanding and some of the processing of the data that happen in the NSSP ecosystem, has to do with the capture of what happens to a patient when they come to an urgent care center, perhaps, and then are transferred to an emergency department and then become an inpatient and then are seen in follow-up. And the way that we have operated in Massachusetts is that we are an NSSP only state. So we're really leveraging the great work that CDC has done and we're not collecting any additional data locally. And so we really want that system to function in a way that integrates the information across the patient care experience. The one other thing I'll say, and I'm aware that we're wanting to change topics, is that idea of bidirectional flow and the utility of these data to hospitals, we've really struggled to engage our providers as much as they want to provide us data. We spent many years kind of trying to create some sort of data product or engagement with our data providers. And for the most part, there are many other places where they can get similar data. And certainly the idea of any kind of automated alert, I think this is what Carl was saying too, I was gonna say dangerous. It's probably not dangerous, but it risks just overwhelming our data providers with information that's not gonna be particularly useful to them. We continue to find that our astute public health professionals and clinicians are the ones who first alert us to things. And then what the syndromic surveillance data allow us to do is to dig in and understand what's going on. So my perspective is that this is syndromic surveillance has somewhat limited utility as an alerting mechanism, mm-hmm. but it does have a huge amount of utility in terms of situational awareness, digging in to understand, especially in the, we've had a lot of focus on health disparities. So really understanding who's affected, where they're affected, and thinking about resource allocation and prevention activities. I think there were a few other items, but I'll leave it there.
You can put them in the comments. Those get recorded as well. A huge, huge thank you to all of our panelists today. Much appreciated. And Arian, I'll turn it over to you to start walking us through the worksheet. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, we continue to have good engagement into the worksheet. So we're now starting, I don't know if Liz is on, but we're now starting to color code the worksheet to at least get some visibility into where we have work that we have discussed and that is turned into recommendations, and then where we have open items for discussion. Since we've already gone through the immunization registry content a couple of times, I'd suggest that we go to the lab, reportable lab, thank you, as our filter, and go through and discuss the extant recommendations or discussion here. I don't think Hans is on, I think Hans is noting that there is a next generation LRI guide, we probably should be transitioning the ELR guide to the next generation LRI guide, as opposed to the bespoke ELR guide. Just for point of reference, the LRI guide was originally published 10 years ago. And the goal was to unify the ambulatory, reporting to the ordering provider, as well as reporting to public health, and make sure that we had a comprehensive guide that addressed both needs, that then mapped and married to an LOI guide. I neglected, but I will go back in here and add reference to our addendum in the ISP task force on broad recommendations for lab and order, which were intended both to create a better ecosystem for bidirectional communication of orders to labs for ordering providers, as well as address some of the root cause issues associated with public health reporting. So again, Hans and Stephen and Hans in 19 are saying basically the same thing, and I think we should consolidate this down to a single recommendation that we that we go to a consolidated LRI guide. All right. Are we going to explain the color scheme that we're using? Oh, ouch, that hurts. Anyway, there we go. Perfect. Okay. So, cool. Good. Here's the color scheme that we're using. Green, I locked. So we've sort of consolidated down to the recommendations text itself. Yellow is in progress. Red is, I can't read because I've got the chat over. It's a duplicate. And so we're gonna try to find the right color scheme and keep it pretty simple. But if you're looking through and you've got this sort of reddish color, not so heinous on the eyes color, we've got we've potentially have a duplicate. All right. Les is noting that ONC should work with CMS to provide financial incentives for low-income coding and incentive for free text reporting. And again, I'm an advocate for let's actually re-endorse and re-recommend related activities that we contemplated already in the ISP task force, because we spent a lot of time constructing that text, and it addresses, for example, the ecosystem issues associated with low-income encoding, making sure that we've got information fully through from IBDs, et cetera. So Hans notes I think this is an area where this is duplicative of the information that Hans already was a huge help in the ISP task force guide. So I would recommend people read that. I'll make sure that it's linked into the spreadsheet itself. And there may be things that we want to add to those recommendations, but I'd want to sort of re-endorse those recommendations because they already went through the HIT advisory committee. They're already in ONC's hands, and I think it would be appropriate for us to re-endorse and re-recommend those recommendations. Structurally, they weren't exactly recommendations just based on the structure of the ISP task force. So we have the opportunity to turn them into recommendations in this task force. This Hans comment 53 was a note that we also made in that report that we really want to rely on as we get as we include ECR and the ECR implementation guide as the certification criteria associated with the ECR existing ECR certification guide. We want to get to a world where we're relying on ECR for capture of the contextual information, and we want to keep the ELR report specific to the actual laboratory findings in most cases, rather than overload ELR with additional clinical contextual information that makes it hard to implement ELR. One of the nice things about ECR is that it is already trigger-based, and you can already add and modify trigger conditions in order to pull or to make sure that public health has access to that information. So Hans notes, recommend that ONC and CDC work towards a common standards-based lab reporting submission process that can work through one or more reduced hubs or networks rather than the current point-to-point processes. I'd note that AIMS already exists. So maybe when Hans is back, we can talk about that one. Hans notes that we should create a shared process through which enhancements to standards can be managed to recognize the need for variation. So this is really around setting a floor. And what I don't think we've heard is where the common variation is in ELR, state by state. What I'm seeing Hans point to is again the jurisdictional variation in terms of the contextual information that goes along with the lab result, and using mechanisms like AOE as the place to collect contextual information. I wonder, Jillian or anybody else on the call, whether we've got a view about where there is state by state variation in terms of sort of the actual ELR content. I think we've heard loud and clear the need to collect complete demographic information, complete contact information. I think we've heard loud and clear the need to be more granular in race and ethnicity. But in terms of deficiencies or lack of, you know, a variation in the ELRI guide itself, I haven't heard. Erin, your hand is up. Erin?
Yeah. Hi. Erin Holt, Tennessee Department of Health. So, I mean, one comment I would make to that as far as variation, I think it's detailed in both the ELR R1 implementation guide, as well as more completely detailed in the various LRI implementation guides, is the method in which we document parent-child relationships, which are particularly important for micro results. There can be some differences of interpretation of what that guidance is or expectation is from the implementation guides. And I suspect that that could be or is very well some of the source or could be a source of variation across jurisdictions and how that's implemented.
Erin, would you recommend tightening that or providing a little bit more context to it? Or what would you?
Well, in LRI, there was some intentional time and energy spent in clarifying the syntax around supporting parent-child relationships. And so if one of the recommendations is to be able to more widely adopt LRI, we might be able to see some of that variation resolve because of that additional context and guidance and clarity provided.
Perfect. Yeah, that was my intuition as well, is that we put a ton of work into the LRI implementation guide, and that much of the ELR reporting issue is secondary to just not having gone to the latest version of LRI, as well as overloading ELR with case investigation, where if we had broader use of ECR, we'd be in better shape there. So Hans again notes, We should use the latest LRI implementation guide. So I think we can get that message pretty loud and clear. Let's keep going down. All right, so we're done with the current set of comments on for reportable lab tests and results. I owe the task force a set of recommendations secondary to sort of re-endorsing the ISP task force recommendations on lab and order. I think the other thing that we heard, which I went back and re-looked through our ISP task force recommendations and was an oversight on our part there. One of the other things that I think we need to re-endorse or make sure is loud and clear in our recommendations is the need for the lab result that is sent to public health to contain complete and accurate both demographic and contact information that is sufficient to start a case investigation as well as sufficient for person matching. I think given the infrastructure that we outline in the ISP task force recommendations, we've got a broad platform for doing that, but we should just make sure that point is heard loud and clear. Anything else on LRIs? Ike, you've got your name up. We're going to go to ECR next. Ike, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we need to also ensure that we address the ask and order entry questions in that same space and looking at how do we want to treat that.
Yeah, so the question on AOE is, do we want the issue with AOE is that there's a time lag between wanting to get, so, you know, Zika was the poster child for use of AOE. And there's a there's a time lag between wanting to get better context around the lab and getting AOE more broadly deployed. The thought process is that as we get broader use of ECR, that we can address, for example, travel health history, pregnancy status, the things that vary from outbreak to outbreak more directly by broader use of ECR than by mandating use of a more flexible AOE system. That might be a point of discussion as opposed to that's an opinion I know that Hans had when we were putting together the ISP task force recommendations. I think it came across in the ELR conversation that we had, is that a lot of the work that ELR is doing could be better served through broader use of ECR. But that was the thought process that I had there. We made more discussion on that point.
I just ask a quick point of clarification? When we're talking about ask on order entry, we're not speaking about the same thing as electronic test order entry, so ETOR. Those are two different, I just want to make sure that we're clear that those are two very different things.
maybe you can explain ETOR and then we can.
So ETOR is from the provider to the laboratory with the test order and containing all of the information that's relevant to go to the laboratory and potentially expanding that to make sure that we're including the information that also would need to go to public health, and also is the return message from the laboratory to the provider. Ask for an order entry was something that came up, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, my public health colleagues, that came up during the pandemic specifically, and it would contain very specific questions that were outside of what would normally be included on ETOR. On ETOR.
The evolution of ask order entry has been around for a long time, but was first looked at in practice, I believe, looking at Zika response, not COVID-19. And it was an identified need to get very specific information regarding people that were being tested for Zika, including pregnancy status and things like that. I think the bigger issue kind of going forward and looking at experience with COVID-19, where ask and order entry still very much needs to be on the table, is looking at how a lot of testing actually occurred for COVID-19 with drive-through testing without a recommendation coming from a person's normal healthcare provider. And if you're relying solely on ECR from a healthcare provider, you're missing that information gathered at the point of testing in that particular circumstance. So I think it's something we very much need to be concerned and cognizant about.
Cool. So Hung is going to come on and educate us all, but I want to emphasize that AOE is a generic capability that serves the need for orders to capture additional contextual information relative to the lab order itself. So it's not a public health capability. It is a general lab ordering capability to allow an order to contain additional information that is contextual in nature and intended for the lab. And I think we've used the AOE capability for capturing some contextual information that is associated with the order, but also contextual information that's associated with the person and the clinical context for use.
But we would want the ETOR to be to contain all of the relevant demographic information that it's sort of standardized upon, like, you know, asking for a test versus the actual. So I just want to make sure that we're talking about those things in two very different.
Hung, you had your hand up and maybe you're going to make the same point I just made, or you've got additional information you want to drop on us.
Yeah. So I was just going to say that, you know, ask on order entry has been around for a very long time, you know, such as with fasting lipid, where we want to know whether a patient has been fasting. And so it was kind of a workaround used during the COVID pandemic to get additional information that currently could not be pulled automatically. But ideally, should be gleaned from the patient's information rather than having the clinician input that information, because there is a wide range of providers who order these. It could be a trainee who's not familiar. And so it's really not a very controlled or standardized process. But, you know, so if there was a way to automatically pull in that information and convey it later into the reporting, that would be ideal versus absent order entry, which could be very prone to error.
Yeah, but again, the risk point here is looking at having no information if patient's first encounter or first major seeking of care or treatment or testing is directly with a laboratory provider, thinking about all the drive-through testing that went on in COVID-19. Without collecting that information, ask an order entry at that point, the information is lost to public health. And to Jillian's point, even the eTort data isn't really there. Either you don't have the patient demographic data unless it's collected by the laboratory.
This is a fantastic point. Brian, can you do us the favor of posting that observation into the spreadsheet itself so that we can then turn that into recommendation? And, you know, it's sort of similar to the lateral flow sort of rapid test, consumer test issue, where as we get more convenient testing options, we run the risk of reducing the contextual information that we have and reducing the reportability of that issue. So I think that is a really important issue. Thank you for that. And we certainly don't mean when we want to rely on ECR for providing contextual information and not overloading AOE in the way that Hung notes the issues associated with it. We're not intending to lose context in places where lab is the first point of contact. Why don't we go to case reporting and do a rapid run through our case reporting. Thank you, Liz. So cool. And this is a generic comment, and I heard it can't come up again in the syndromic surveillance issue, that we, for whatever reason, healthcare has this obsession with OIDs. I'm not entirely certain where this OID obsession came from. But we heavily use OIDs, which were originally adopted around a standard that's used for signing certificates and encryption certificates, and are used in cases where you need to have highly compressed information. And we for some reason have decided to use them very heavily in healthcare. We need to have directories that better associate these rather opaque identifiers with the actual settings of care where they're received. So we want to turn this one into a recommendation that is tied both to ECR as well as to syndromic surveillance and potential ELR as well, that we have access to directory information that helps us disambiguate settings of care. Next one, which I think is duplicative with something that I put in, so I will mark mine as duplicative, from Vivian, is included in EHR certification, the ability to access and update. Maybe what happened is I took Vivian's and actually turned it into a recommendation. I recognize my own writing style here. So our recommendation here is that, so the observation is that we see in practice some systems that have up-to-date access to trigger codes and trigger value sets and actual triggers. And some systems that are stale with regard to their updates to triggers. So the proposed recommendation here is recommending that we include in the EHR certification program for ECR, not just the ability to send an ECR, but also the ability to update associated value sets and triggers dynamically and periodically, that we create operating rules for those updates, and that we create the appropriate mechanisms that encourage provider organizations to adhere to the operating rules. So I'm going to pause there. Okie doke. Vivian, establish a nationwide common floor for something.
Aaron, I may have started this. I was thinking, and I never came back to it.
No problem.
I absolutely apologize about.
No problem. Cool. We've all been there. So I think the recommendation here would be, in fact, that we standardize the ECR criteria. I'm not sure if I addressed this in the recommendation text itself, but I think we want to actually recommend the ECR standard and implementation guide. I think I do someplace, and that should serve as a means for broader adoption and onboarding to ECR. So 28, I think, turns into a recommendation that we certify public health data systems for the corresponding ECR requirements, that their systems have the ability to in a more automated fashion, receive the ECR content, as opposed to building workarounds to turn it into, for example, faxes that then get manually re-entered into systems. Les notes that, 29 is duplicative with 26. And 33, Les notes that we should work to create a single harmonized standard for triggering of ECR reports and a single harmonized standard for initial reporting. I think we have that. So I think that's just re-endorsing the work that's already happening and making sure that we have ongoing access to it. I see people nodding. I'm not sure ONC can create legislation less. Where I would recommend that we
ONC can draft standardized legislation, not it wouldn't in for states. That's yeah. Something that CDC does all the time too.
Yeah, model legislation. I maybe the ONC team can comment, but I'm not sure that ONC has historically been in the game of doing model legislation. If we think it's worth turning that into a recommendation, that would be fantastic. The other thing that I think we can contemplate is making sure that that the ECR, that the way that certification is framed for ECR allows for modular certification in ways that would allow, for example, a state HIE to serve as the hub or intermediary for ECR.
Not every state also has a robust HIEs, I would also say. So, I think we do need some flexibility there. And I think also around electronic case reporting, there certainly is a centralized approach for that. So how would this impact that?
Yeah, so my proposal here would be to turn this into a recommendation that we have modular certification for ECR reporting in ways that would allow a provider organization to use their EHR as the module, or use their partnership with the state HIE as the module. And that level of modular certification is already in use across ONC and allows flexibility for provider organizations to sort of mix and match capabilities to address the certification requirements that they might have attached to programs.
Arian, this is Steve Eichner.
Yeah.
I think it's important that public health determine how it wants or what opportunities it wants to provide to the healthcare providers for connecting into its system. In Texas, for example, participation in health information exchanges is voluntary by providers, and we support connections both through HIEs and through other networks. Other states may have different requirements or different components, and giving the health departments the ability to specify what they can support and what they are certified against is critical, because some health departments may not be resourced to support multiple types of connections.
Yep. Yeah, it's great. It's a great point. So again, the recommendation here, to make sure that we've got certification on both sides, to make sure that the certification criteria is modular in nature, and that allows us to make sure that we can plug appropriate plug compatible units in ways that address state needs.
But the difference here is, on the provider side, they may need to support all of the capabilities on the receiving side system, where the receiving system may only need to meet one criterion for receiving that data.
That's right. And typically the way we do this in the EHR certification program is that providers need to note the systems that they're using to address the certification criteria. We've gone away from all-in-one certification criteria, where a provider has to adopt an EHR that has every single criterion, because in actual practice, providers have multiple systems, and so they may be using their native EHR as their ECR reporting system, or they may use a different module for that.
But again, the modular certification, the module, whether it's standalone or not, I don't care, needs to support all the mechanisms that public health may use to receive the data. On the public health side, certification need only be one of whatever the set is. That way, the provider is not going to end up in a bad position where state of Texas uses one format and Oklahoma uses a different format, and the provider needs to send data to both.
Well, yeah. So ideally, we'd have certification criteria that would address the format, so we don't actually have format mismatches, although we do have both a CDA and a FHIR-based implementation guide, which can get confusing in practice. Okay, 36. So this is about probabilistic or AI-based or ML-based recognition of notifiable conditions. Les, I don't have a sense for how to turn this into recommendation text.
And actually, I'm going to strongly disagree with this. to put it out there, the role of establishing case definitions is the role of the states and jurisdictions through CSDE. And the beauty of RCKMS is that it has the flexibility of establishing what the trigger codes are for reporting, so that we can have the varying degrees of sensitivity depending upon where we are with a certain stage of disease, in order to have that flexibility in terms of what we need reported to us. So I really think that is the role of the state and the jurisdiction through CSDE to determine what is nationally notifiable and then what is actually reportable within those jurisdictions. Aaron, do you want to comment as well?
You took the words out of my mouth. I would just echo, in particular, the difference between nationally notifiable conditions and state reportable. And if we do recognize that there's a variation across jurisdictions, only focusing on nationally notifiable doesn't necessarily address that variation across the jurisdictions and may even perpetuate it.
Absolutely. And this is Steve, it's not just at a state level, it can be local as well.
Yep, and again, we won't belabor this. Les, if you can do some thought about how we could turn this into a recommendation that would address the concerns that Jillian and Aaron and our public health folks have raised, that would be fantastic, and we can consider it at that time. So 40. All right, so. So this is basically the meat of the how do we turn. So let me give you a little bit of the lay of the land for ECR. ECR right now does not have test methods associated with it. It does not point to an implementation guide, or does not point to a standard or implementation guide. And so Abby and I did a potential reword on this proposes that we actually endorse the existing ECR implementation guide and or ECR standard and the CDA and Firebase implementation guide and establish associated test methods so that we sort of name a standard for the ECR. F criterion. Abby, I don't know if you want to comment on the how do we unify my wording and your wording and what's new and you know how do we get to consensus a consensus statement there. I don't know if Abby's on. All right,
Abby's not on.
And we're going to move to that's right. We have successfully gone through both ECR and lab, and we're going to go to public comment at this point.
Great, thank you so much. So we're going to open up our call for public comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press *9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So we'll pause for just one moment to see if we have anyone raise their hand. Not seeing any hands raised, I'll turn it back to you, Arian and Jillian.
All right. So I think we made fantastic. We're making really record time progress through this work here. It's a substantial amount of work. Really appreciate everybody's digging into the spreadsheet and making sure that we've got good source material to turn into recommendations. As we complete through, we're going to try to keep to this schedule of looking at the last couple back topics and review them in the spreadsheet over time, turn them into recommendations. And then going forward, we should be looking both at the recommendations text as well as the information in the spreadsheet and turning more of the recommendations in the spreadsheet to whatever color it is that we've chosen to finalize recommendations and lock them. We have cancer registries next. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we're heading towards the end of the F criteria. We've gotten through the bulk of the most significant and widely used F criteria. We're going into cancer registries and going into HAIs. And I believe that's it. Jillian, do we have anything else on the docket in terms of F criteria to go through?
Cancer.
The healthcare surveys.
Yeah, healthcare surveys are next.
Yeah, thank you. So we've got cancer, HAIs, and healthcare surveys to get through. And then we're going to be deep into writing the draft recommendations for review.
So we're almost at time. I just really want to thank all of our presenters and as well as all of the comments, been both verbally and within the chat. It's been, a really robust conversation, and I really feel like we're moving forward towards common goals and consensus here. So thank you, everyone, very much.
Indeed. Thanks to our panel and thanks to the task force members for all the engagement. Let's keep it up.
See you next week.
Thanks.
Thank you all.
Bye, guys.